Coming up in our show today, we take a closer look at carbon capture. And how much do you know about Irish black cattle? We're going to learn about the breed. That's today's segment four. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Sabrina Halverson. We start today with a look at spring nutrition for citrus. Joining me on the phone once again is Certified Crop Advisor, Dustin Stewart.
So we're talking about citrus again. Every Tuesday we talk about citrus. And so I wanted to do a check-in with what you're seeing out there in the fields and with people you're talking to. How are things looking so far this spring?
Everything's coming along really fast right now. Seeing a lot of new leaf growth. We're seeing the blooms push out, get very swollen. As of last night or this morning, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock this morning, they declared bloom in District 1, Tulare County. So we're well on our way into bloom right now.
All right. So as we go into bloom, what should growers be paying close attention to right now?
It's going to be very important that you pay close attention to your nutritional levels and inputs right now. Now's the time everybody's going through with what they call their pre-bloom foliar application, and this is going to be a foliar application of nutrition. There's different, depending on what the need is in that particular grove, some opt to go with more of a phosphorus-heavy approach, or others would go with the calcium approach. Some other things that are very important in this window is going to be the addition of both a zinc and a manganese. And those two elements are important to put together in the spray rather than, say, do zinc now and manganese at petal fall. They work. There's more of a synergistic efficacy that's achieved when those two are put together into a spray. Now, that's going to help you set more fruit, just have more of a vigorous bloom, and just have a better chance at setting yourself up for a good year.
With all of the different microsystems pretty much that California has, and even in just the citrus areas, do you see the same problems throughout, if you're in Tulare or if you're in down south more in Southern California, or are we seeing different issues, different parts of the state?
Yeah, it does vary regionally. On the east side, East Valley, you're going to see they're prone to manganese deficiency on the east side. Down south, you're not going to have, like south coastal, you're not going to have much of an issue with manganese uptake. It does depend on where you are located. You're going to see a difference in nutritional needs.
Will the lack of water change anything as we head further into another drought year?
Yes, it is going to, especially with the growers that are strictly on well water. So it's going to be tougher. Anybody who's dependent on surface water, I should say, not getting that allocation of surface water they need and then having to revert to the well water. Some blocks don't even have pumps because they're so dependent on the surface water. So, yes, a lack or reduction of deliveries would have a huge impact.
Mm-hmm. Aside from getting more water, are there things that they need to watch for with the balance of the nutrients in soil when we're talking about with the different water levels? Is that going to change things, how the soil is made up?
It is, because you're going to see an increase in sodium in your soil profile. And so you're going to have to watch your cation exchange capacity in the soil and make sure that the calcium and potassium and magnesium are at the right levels to offset the presence of sodium. And it's going to be hard to push the sodium through the root zone and leach it through to where it's not an issue with groundwater.
So for all of this, is it best to get your soil tested so you know exactly what you've got going on, or are there things that you can visually see, or what's the best way to know exactly what's happening?
First and foremost, I'd definitely go through and pull a soil sample. I would pull that at 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 foot depths if you're in more of a troubled area. It's very important also to get a water sample. And then, of course, once these new leaves are pushed out enough, we're going to want to get an early tissue sample to see where we're at with all that. So we want to know what's present in the soil, what could be an issue, how is the water going to be affecting, is it going to be helping or hurting that situation. But most importantly, we want to see of that reservoir, what is actually being taken up by the tree, what's not being taken up, and how, you know, how the different elements are affecting each other, so you can make a good approach to how you're going to fix it or, you know, handle it for this year.
So, of course, all of the different growing phases are important, but how important would you say this phase is right now for the fruit that we're going to get?
Vital. This is going to, how you handle this, how this goes right here is going to determine your outcome at the end of the season. So this is where all the flowers are getting pollinated. That's where your fruit is getting set. Man, cell division is going to start occurring. So there's a lot of things that are going to be at play here. Probably one of the biggest is cell wall integrity and developing cells. And so that's going to give you a good solid piece of fruit that's going to have shelf life at the end of the day. And it's also going to allow the size to be what you want it to be by developing as many cells as you can that we will fill later.
All right. And if somebody is listening and they would like to talk with you to get more information, or maybe, you know, talk with you about things that are going on in their grove, how can they reach you?
They can reach me at area code 559-994-0291. I'm available all the time, and if I can be of any help, please give me a call, and we will do everything we can to get you on the right track.
Thank you again to Dustin Stewart. Our news brief is up next. We'll be right back.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board. Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Here's your news brief for today. The USDA has reopened signups for the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. It's part of the larger effort to reach a greater share of farming operations and improve USDA pandemic assistance. Farm Service Agency has committed at least $2 million to establish partnerships and direct outreach efforts intended to improve outreach for FSA programs, including CFAP2, and will cooperate with grassroots organizations with strong connections to socially disadvantaged communities to ensure they're informed and aware of the application process. CFAP updates include reopening Coronavirus Food Assistance Program 2, additional payments for eligible cattle and row crop producers, and the processing of payments for certain applications filed as part of the CFAP additional assistance. The initial CFAP 2 signup ended in December, but USDA has reopened the signup period for CFAP 2 for at least 60 days. President Joe Biden spoke to reporters briefly Monday upon his return to the White House, with Marine One helicopter still running in the background. President Biden answered questions about his proposed tax hike.
Are you afraid that a higher tax will drive corporations from the country?
Not at all. Look, the tax, because there's no evidence of that. The tax was 36%. It's now down to 21%. And the idea that's bizarre. We were talking about a 28% tax that everybody thought was just fair enough for everybody. The idea is you have 51 or 52 corporations of the Fortune 500 haven't paid a single penny in tax for 3 years. Come on, man.
In the daily press briefing, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki gave a statement on the infrastructure plan, including mentions of high-speed rail and electric vehicles.
Some Republicans who have been vocal think investing in water systems and replacing pipes so Americans can have clean drinking water is not infrastructure, but the president does. Some don't think investing in high-speed rail is infrastructure. The president does. Some believe building charging stations to support America's electric vehicle future is not infrastructure. He believes it is. Some don't believe that America's broadband capacity, which is one-third of the American people, don't have access to broadband, and improving those lines and expanding that access is not infrastructure. The president does. Some believe that addressing the issue of America's supply chain so that we're never again at the mercy of China or any other nation is not investing in infrastructure. The president disagrees.
And she also took questions on the border and immigration.
We released a poll earlier today that suggests that 25% of Americans, only 25%, approve of the way that the president is handling the situation at the border with respect to unaccompanied minors. So does this poll suggest that the president needs to reevaluate his approach to that issue?
Well, if I read the poll correctly, it also had 59% of Americans believing that unaccompanied children should be treated safely and be protected in that way, and 65% supported the reunification of families. There's no question this is a difficult challenge, and the president believes he was elected to address hard problems. And his focus right now is on expediting processing at the border, opening up additional facilities, addressing the root causes, and restarting programs to incentivize kids from applying from within their countries. So that's his focus right now.
In other news, the National Pork Producers Council is concerned with the increasing number of rescue dogs coming into the U.S. from countries that are currently battling a foreign animal disease. Liz Wagstrom is the NPPC's chief veterinarian. She says they're especially concerned about dogs coming into America from Asian wet markets or the meat trade, where they could be contaminated by blood, urine, or manure.
That could then serve to carry African swine fever or foot and mouth disease or classical swine fever. The dogs themselves are not susceptible to those diseases, but they could have contamination on their coats, their bedding could be contaminated, even dishes or toys that they came in with could be contaminated. So our concern is that one of those animals could come into the United States, be adopted by somebody on a farm, and be carrying virus in the contamination on their coat, or that the crates and other hard items like bowls or bedding could be improperly disposed of and feral pigs could get into them.
The NPPC wants rules in place to protect U.S. livestock herds. The organization says USDA definitely has the authority to oversee dogs that come in for either sale or adoption. Wagstrom says a foreign animal disease getting into the United States would have a devastating impact on livestock.
A foreign animal disease would immediately shut down all trade, so we would end up with an excess number of animals. And even if it were African swine fever that only impacts the pig industry, we would have trading partners that may question milk and meat and poultry exports. The depressed prices for pork could end up depressing prices for beef and poultry and milk products as well. So it would be a multiple billion-dollar hit to the entire livestock industry.
To help keep livestock safe, NPPC says the U.S. needs more agricultural inspectors at borders and ports. Hemp cultivated for seed and grain comprised approximately 10% of 2020 total U.S. acreage and approximately 1,400 acres, according to data provided by Hemp Benchmarks. By comparison, Canadian cultivators grew more than five times that acreage, beyond 75,000 acres, the vast majority of which was exported to the United States. That's your news brief for today. Still to come, a closer look at carbon credits.
Having problems with nematodes? ProMax is your number one solution. ProMax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. ProMax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/ProMax for more information.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews, and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
We're hearing a lot these days about carbon credits. So who will buy carbon credits and what will they be worth? Those were the questions asked at the recent AgriPulse Ag and Food Summit during a panel discussion. Representatives from three companies were invited to be on the panel. We start with comments from Dr. Chris Harbert, Global Head of Carbon of Indigo Agriculture.
Really excited to talk to everyone today and really excited for the questions. So like Phil said, please ask questions of us. There's so many questions in this area. So I want to be clear, I think up front, maybe the right way to say this is Indigo's in the carbon credit business today. We have active programs. We're involved in linking together farmers, Indigo, and our atmosphere together really are the goals of what we're trying to do. We're connecting buyers of carbon credits to a high quality supply of those credits. We're working with agriculture to accomplish that. I think the right way to contextualize what I'm doing or who I represent here as Indigo is just a staff of scientists, science first, science led company, policy and ag experts, regenerative agriculture experts, financial engineers, thinking of the right ways to work through some of the financial aspects of these programs, and an enterprise sales team working with the buyers of those carbon credits. So that's what makes up the Indigo team. It's diverse, it's deep, it's a large team, and we're executing, we're getting it done today. And I think about the most important aspect of our team in generating carbon credits, it's the grower. And right now our growers are supplying over 2 million acres of opportunity for us to create carbon credits on. That's where we're at today. So the program's growing. We're in over 21 states currently. Lots of interest, lots of excitement, lots of participation, and lots of credits being generated too. We're in the first year of the program of generating credits. The 2020 vintage was our first year. So we're coming out of that now and issuing them through the high standards of a registry approval process. And a very high quality credit outcome is what we're looking for. And frankly, what the buyers are looking for. We're staying customer focused. Our customers are the buyers, the credit buyers. So I think it's important to say is I lead a real company, a real team who's accomplishing this today and getting it done. This is not just an experiment out there. This is a real legitimate business that we're operating. And a number of others are out there operating as well. There's a lot of half-truths and other concepts out there about carbon too that cause confusion. It's too hard. Is it too early? Is it, there's so many middlemen in this that there's hardly anything in it left for the grower. And those are just untrue. Our program certainly has a share with the grower of 75% or more. And that's a significant inclusion and a significant portion going to the farmers. So we're really trying to do the hard work to make sure these programs are sustainable overall, that the credits being generated are beyond reproach and of the highest quality to meet that demand of credit buyers, but also to really pull this together in a way that thinks carefully and thoughtfully about the farmer and the challenges of what we're asking them to do to participate in a carbon program, but also in the changes they have to make to their operation in order to realize this revenue stream coming from carbon. And it's not just the revenue from carbon, it's a mix of the benefits, both to soil health and to the environment from participating in these practices. So I'm passionate about agriculture. I know Phil, and we talked to introduce us personally. I grew up in agriculture, grew up in farming. I've got degrees in ag engineering, PhD in soil science and agricultural engineering. Spent many years as a scientist in professional science, working in and around agriculture, both in the U.S. and globally. I've got an entrepreneurial bent, started software companies in the past, worked in sustainability plays and trying to figure out the right way to get software into the hands of farmers in a way that's useful, achievable, and relevant to their business day in and day out. And I came to Indigo because of the people there, some of what I described, the great group that we have executing on carbon credits, and sort of the mission of the company too, to look out for the health of all of us and the planet. And I've just built this great leadership role with a deep team who's getting it done today. So I think it's just a really great opportunity. We're seeing this market unfold right in front of us. Where, for example, we're sold out of our 2020 vintage of credits. We've sold all that we could produce, and we're looking forward to the next year, the 2021 vintage. We've actually raised our prices on carbon credits, so I'm sure we'll talk more about that in terms of how those prices are set and where that's headed. Happy to talk more about that. But to think about all of the ways we can make these programs really sticky, the additionality constraints, the realness, the credits have to actually exist to keep everyone honest, the buyers, the producers, and all of us in the process. And making sure that that stickiness is there for the growers so that it becomes something that's really important to their business long-term, that the changes we're asking them to make to their farms today to help with the climate abatement concepts, that we're able to really step in and say, these are the right practices for you. They're making financial sense on their own. And when we talk to growers that have employed these for some time, this is nothing new. The core technology here in carbon crediting is photosynthesis. And when we think about photosynthesis and what that means, it's a technology today that we can bring to bear today. But farmers who are engaged in some of these regenerative practices that we'll talk more about today, they'll lean over and tell you, Chris, it's unfair farming. There's a real advantage to these programs beyond just the carbon credits too. So just excited to talk about that today and share experiences and where we're at with Indigo. So
next is Ben Farger, Managing Director of Sustainability for the Ag Supply Chain in North America with Cargill.
We're obviously leaning in to this challenge. We're committed to the profitable, sustainable nature of agriculture in the United States and, of course, globally, and we want to give our farmers an opportunity to participate as these markets emerge. Really, it goes without saying, it's logical, but we're not going to get the environmental outcome or the food production outcome unless you're working with the people that are producing the food and managing the environment, being our farm customers. And so what we're doing, as many others are really trying to understand how farmers are part of the solution to this endeavour. So what we're doing, Phil, is we've got a portfolio of sustainability initiatives already on the ground in North America and in the United States more specifically. And we're really intentional about that sustainability, because if you really want to meet farmers where they are and be true to that principle of making growers part of the solution, because we've got different production types, commodity mix, soil types, and each farm enterprise is different, we want to understand the flexible nature of and the multiple pathways growers can get into. So we're working with farmers in the west of the United States on cover crops and conservation tillage, rotation management, looking at how we cost share and provide support for farmers to get involved in those activities up front and understand cost and revenue aspects of that. We're working along the Mississippi River on cover crop programs with customers, demand customers and growers, and working with alliances around agronomy and other stakeholders, partners, NGOs, to work out what models work for farmers and what our growers like and don't like about them. We've got innovation and some innovative projects like the Soil and Water Outcomes Fund, where we seek to stack the carbon benefit with a water benefit, an ecosystem service to give farmers more recognition of the work they're doing, not just on carbon, but water and indeed conservation, agriculture more broadly. And we've learned a lot of insights about that. We've actively got under development, several other programs where we're seeking to engage more in the offset pathway, not just the inset carbon pathway, which I'm sure we might talk about, Phil. And then we've got nutrient and fertilizer programs involved as well. And so a portfolio, a sustainability portfolio. And I guess I'd summarise it by really talking about what we're learning and what growers are talking to us about. And they're saying, we want to understand the economics of how it works, the cost and the benefit around that. We want to understand the technology, the measurement, the monitoring, verification, and what's happening with data and decision support around that. We want to understand the flexibility of these programs. How are they suited to my production system and how it might change over time? And is it easy to understand and indeed simple so that I can access it and make a start? And the last point I think is really important for not just us as a company, but the industry and government, and the whole endeavour here is trust and transparency in this system, not just for our demand customers who are looking at either insetting or purchasing offsets, but for the growers, the transparency about the different commercialisation opportunities, how they work, what their options are, how they're developing over time, issues around data and technology. And that's a really important cornerstone of what we're doing as well, Phil. So that's a snapshot of some of our activity in this space.
And next, comments from Jason Weller, Vice President of Truterra.
This is a good deal. And the fact that this is such a become such a hot and I think global conversation is also, it gives me solace. Jason Weller, a member here of Truterra and the Truterra team. Let me just give a very brief background, Phil, for the audience here. Truterra is a part of Land O'Lakes, and for the broader audience, Land O'Lakes is one of the largest farmer cooperatives and ag retailer cooperatives in the country. So Truterra, we are the sustainability business that is working hand in hand with the rest of the Land O'Lakes enterprise, but critically with our owners. And this, when I say owners, they really are. We're a federated co-op system where we have ag retailers, independent retailers, and farmer cooperatives that own Land O'Lakes. And so we work in very close partnership with those retailer network partners to design and bring to the market different sustainability solutions. I have a background in conservation. I'm very proud to have been part of the Land O'Lakes family for the last 4 years, but prior to that, have been in the public sector, working side by side at USDA with conservation professionals, with great national conservation organizations, and with state and local partners, small water districts and state agencies. And I've seen the huge progress we've made collectively as a conservation community, but also really the huge emerging challenges, such as a changing climate. And what's fun and what's really energizing for me is to be part of a team at Land O'Lakes that is farmer owned and really a retailer driven model, where they want to not just be part of the conversation, but really be leading from the front and engaging with our farmer owners and our farmer customers on what's next. And what's next is what I really, we're talking about is this next evolution in agriculture, which is really unfolding before our eyes, which is really energizing and rewarding to be part of. And part of that future is really around a global demand in sustainability, where we see consumers and therefore companies starting to realign around activating their buying choices and trying to influence their purchasing decisions and how that flows back uphill. But also increasingly voters and governments, right, are also increasingly concerned about the direction our environment is going. And so what's in this case really energizing and rewarding is to be part of a solution where farmers can be part of this model, where it's incentive-based, it's voluntary. And what we're trying to figure out here at Land O'Lakes is how do we really weave this conversation around sustainable farming, conservation farming, into the broader need to feed a growing population. So at the heart of this, Phil, is it's a conversation about a 100-year-old farmer co-op thinking about the next 100 years. And how do we work as partners with companies, including Cargill and Indigo here, that we're bringing to market together really innovative ideas and new solutions, new technologies, but it has to work for the grower, it has to work for the farmer in the way that's integrated with their farming operation. So instead of a top-down solution, we really work as a problem solver and we bring ideas and solutions to the farmer and identify with them what works best for their farm, critically optimizing their ROI, their farm success, because if we're not solving economic value, the rest is for naught. And to be clear, carbon credits are definitely part of the solution and is a new opportunity. But it's not the end of the means. It's really the beginning of the next phase of precision agriculture and precision farming. And so we did launch recently our True Carbon offer, which is another entrant into this carbon market space. And we can talk about the details of that. We're really designing this in a way where we can create high quality credits for the buyer in this case, but also critically have a great experience for the farmer, maximizing the return for the farmer, recognizing their stewardship and compensating them correctly and appropriately, but doing this in a way where we're not turning them into data farmers. We're trying to help them be actually grain producers, but along the way also store and sequester carbon and eventually also reduce emissions. So it's a holistic solution that works in concert with their agronomy, really with their crop success and their soil health management. And on the back end, we're then helping to reward and recognize that great agronomy stewardship, and in this case, compensate them for good carbon credit solutions as well.
Panel moderator Philip Brasher of AgriPulse asked the direct question, what can farmers expect to get paid?
Let's cut to the chase here. What are farmers, what can they expect to get paid? Ratan Lal, who's the one of the leading soil carbon scientists in the world, was the 2020 winner of the World Food Prize, has said that it's going to take about $40 a ton, he thinks, to really make it worthwhile for farmers to sequester carbon and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's well above where I think what anybody is really paying now. Is that realistic?
Jason Weller had this response.
Not realistic. I think it's necessary. It's foundational. I think it's not, let's be really clear. It's not what organizations are paying. It's what the market is purchasing, to be really clear. So there's definitely a supply and demand, and the curves need to meet. The good news is that we're actually having a conversation around a market, and that there's actually growing demand for these kind of services. There's a lot to resolve, and not to get too wonky, but there's a lot that will drive value for the buyer and value for the supplier, in this case, the farmers or suppliers. On the demand side, as more and more companies enter this space and more buyers enter this marketplace, we believe supply creation is really gonna be one of the biggest challenges. And so in that, where you have increasing demand but constrained supply, we hope there'll be price accretion.
Next, what do producers need to do the work? Ben Farger with Cargill had this.
Great question, Phil, and I do agree with what Jason was talking about as well. I think there's the demand side, obviously, we're seeing from companies both in our food supply chain and outside our food supply chain that have made significant commitments, science-based, net zero, beyond net zero commitments. And so that demand's growing, but also as the understanding and recognition of agricultural-based, nature-based solutions and the credibility of that and farming really being part of the solution here grows, we can see that demand profile increasing. Obviously, these markets are nascent and they're developing, so not without complexity and challenge at the moment, which is why we're all in a serious endeavor to try and put farmers at the center of this. But then there's obviously the grower side and what it will take to adopt. And there's one thing about a price per ton that people are talking about, and there's various prices in the market, obviously. But then, of course, the key variable is how much carbon sequestering per acre, how many tons per acre in terms of what the return's going to be, and what's the cost of doing that, both short-term, as Jason talked about, in terms of the upfront initial costs, and then over time as that curve goes out. And that's why we're involved in a lot of cost-sharing arrangements and agronomic support at the moment to try and really understand that curve and what it's going to take growers and the different segments of growers in terms of people that have adopted these practices previously and are now looking to what their options are. And so there are prices, and people talk about, $10, $20, $30 a ton. People are talking about, $20 to $30 an acre. Some of our programs on the ground are between that $20 to $50 an acre, and it depends on how much carbon you're sequestering. So there's a range of values out there, and that will develop. But I would like to just make one other point, which is why I talked about that sustainability portfolio before, and that is while carbon's obviously extremely important, we're talking about it today, there are other co-benefits or stacking opportunities in agriculture, like we're seeing through, in our case, the Soil and Water Outcomes Fund, with the opportunity to be able to recognise farmers for water benefits as well, where that's relevant, where you can really get that return profile up. And of course, there's the understanding of the economics of the agronomic and the production system benefits themselves in terms of your profitability as a grower. And I think it's complex, but agriculture obviously is a system. And so looking at some of these solutions as a system and the outcome as a system is important, rather than just you know, if it's X or Y dollars per ton for this particular period of time.
That full session and other sessions from the AgriPulse Ag and Food Summit are available through the AgriPulse website. We'll be right back with more of My Ag Life.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
As I've mentioned in some of my posts online, one of my favorite things about my job is the opportunity to learn new things about agriculture. I had the opportunity to learn about Irish Black Cattle with rancher Deb Brown. She's with the Irish Black Cattle Association and owner and operator of Long Pines Livestock. Tell me, let's start off with explaining to me some of the differences between, say, other breeds of cattle.
I think the most unique aspect of the Irish Black Cattle is that they were developed totally in the United States by geneticist Morris Boney. He developed these cattle in the 1960s and 70s, and these cattle are so unique that he had them trademarked. And to my knowledge, they are the only trademarked animal in the United States, on the cattle side. So he started with some Revolution Angus lines, and then he bred them to three meat-type Friesian sires that he brought over from Ireland. He did 17 crosses and then closed his herd books and then continued the line breeding on these animals. Basically, he wanted to eliminate any type of genetic issues that could possibly develop from the line breeding. And the end result is a very fertile animal, an animal that is very feed efficient, and an animal that produces enough milk without too much milk production, works well in most environments, anywhere from the humid south to the very frigid north.
From what I understand, there are Irish Black and also Irish Red cattle?
That is correct. The Irish Reds were basically developed from the Irish Blacks because they have a red recessive gene, and it's very similar to what you would see in the coloration in the Angus breed. And what we have found is that there really is not much difference in the two animals except for coloring.
As you mentioned earlier, they thrive in several different locations.
Absolutely. What we really, you know, we get very cold here in northwestern South Dakota, and it's not uncommon for us to hit 20 below weather in the wintertime. And then sometimes we hit, you know, way quite a bit. We can have long streaks where we're way over 100 degrees. So we need an animal that's going to be very hardy, it's going to have good footing, it's going to be fairly maintenance free, you know, with just its with just regular cattle maintenance with our vaccination program. But we want somebody who's going to get a really good hair cover in the wintertime and then also slick off really well in the summer. And that is something that the Irish Blacks do. In the fact that they are located from coast to coast and north and south in the United States, I think is a testament to the adaptability of these animals.
Popularity versus other breeds of cattle, how would you say the Irish Black cattle rate in the U.S.?
I believe that the Irish Blacks are one of those little known secrets out there. There are very few Irish Black breeders. In fact, there's a listing on the Irish Black Cattle Association website, you know, where you can find producers. But these ranches are mostly small, and we're not located across the United States. So when you call to find an Irish Black breeder, or you look it up on the website, you're probably going to be buying an animal out of the center of the United States because there just aren't a lot of large breeders. And that is one of the reasons that we don't have EPDs as well, because we do not have the sheer volume of animals that it would take to be statistically relevant. So what most breeders have done is move towards getting their own genetic testing, and that way we can have the predictability as a tool in our herd. And I know we have done that for several years through a genetic company, and we've been very pleased with our results because we are now, I think, better informed on what the genetics are on our animal, and it gives us another tool along with ultrasound testing to make sure that we have uniformity in our herd, good IMF, and a quality product to sell.
So with the uncertain cattle market, both short and long term, what can ranchers do with their herd?
I think that there are a lot of different opinions on that. I think we each have to look at what works best for our own unique herd. For my program, we have found that running a moderate-sized animal has decreased our feed inputs. It has allowed us to run more animals. And I always look at my animals, at my animal units. So if I can sell more calves at the end of the year, I'm always happy to be able to do that. And I think that genetics is also a really important issue. If we don't have uniform cattle to take to that sale barn or market, we are going to have some issues because, let's face it, our buyers want to have animals that are very uniform. And I think that that's where the Irish Black comes in, because we have that uniformity, and it is passed with the tight gene pool, it's passed down from one generation to the next. And we also have insisted on productivity from both our bulls and our cows. And if things are challenging enough, let's do what we can to make sure that we have the best product available for the consumer, because quality sells.
So let's talk bull power. How do you think cattle producers can save money on bulls?
Okay. You know what, when we're in a situation, you know, cash is a little bit tight. I caution everyone to really consider the genetics that they're putting into their cattle herds, because is it actually going to pay to buy a lower quality bull? And this has already been rough. So now imagine next year that you've got a calf crop on the ground and you're having calving problems, you're having other issues. It's only going to make the situation more difficult. And you still got those same expenses, maybe higher, and less pounds to sell. So when we introduced our Irish Blacks to what was probably just an average cow herd, there was a very positive change in that first spring. We had some easy calving, vigorous calves, and they did very, very well on our native grasses. What I like the best, though, is the genetic predictability of the Irish Blacks and the Irish Reds. I always say that they're like peas in a pod. You're going to have a few on the outer sides, but most every one of those animals is going to be uniform. And that's what the buyer is looking for to put on feed.
What would you say surprises producers the most about the Irish Black bulls?
I think the biggest surprise is that these bulls actually do breed 50 to 70 cows each. And that means that you only need to use about half the bull battery that you would normally have. And on the Long Pines Land and Livestock website, we have a really nice breakdown on what the cost savings is per bull. When you consider that the Irish Blacks last a very long time in a bull battery. In fact, it's not unusual to see an 8-year-old bull still breeding, you know, 30, 40, 50 cows.
What about the females?
Well, the females are wonderful. They have, to describe them really succinctly, they have longevity, productivity, fertility, and low-cost inputs per animal, meaning that they're very efficient. I love the disposition on our Irish Blacks. I love the moderate size, the good solid feed on these animals, and they are just what I had always been looking for in a cow.
Looking to the future, what expectations do you have for the cattle industry in the upcoming years?
Well, I think that 2020, with all of its challenges, has really brought the focus on the entire food chain from production to distribution. But what doesn't change is that the cattle have to be efficient, they have to adapt to a wide environment, and they've got to provide the consumers with great beef and a good eating experience. We want our consumers and our customers to come back time after time and again to have a good quality eating experience. We all need to look forward to proving the advantages of the United States cattle industry. And we can all be very proactive and effectively communicate these issues to our consumers, because the United States, in my opinion, produces the best beef. And I don't know if our consumers actually understand that. So education on the home front is very important.
Looking toward the near future, what do you think that the cattle industry is heading toward, or what can the cattle industry expect? Is there a light at the end of this tunnel?
I believe that there is. I wouldn't be staying in the cattle industry if I didn't think that we were going to see improvements. Now, we always have basically a five-year cycle with ups and downs in our cattle markets. We always have had outside competition. It's probably a little more relevant now that we're more informed as cattle producers. There have always been chain issues. We just need to get ourselves in a position where we can add some value to our animals. I think most important is going to be some third-party verification, because the customer and a consumer that is ultimately ending up with our animal wants to know that this animal has, you know, where it came from, where it's been, and how it got to their dinner plate. If we change our genetics and improve the muscle and the intermuscular fat and increase the quality on the animals, we're going to have more demand. I think that maybe that some of the marketing practices that we've had in the past will probably have to be changed and adapted to fit what the customer wants.
That's everything that I had. Is there anything else or any other message that you would really like to get across to our listeners?
I'm hoping that we can all remain fairly positive, because ranching is a difficult, challenging job. And we're made from some pretty hard stuff. If we didn't love what we were doing, we wouldn't be continuing to work with volatile markets and crazy weather and just difficulty from time to time. What we need to do is realize that we are all very resilient and that we have the ability to get through this. Talk to your banker. Put together a good business plan. Talk to your local auction. See what's going to work best. Maybe consider online auctions. Consider private treaty. Look at different means of digital sales. We've gone that direction, and I think it's been very effective for us. It may not work for everyone, but I think we need to look outside the box. And if it's working, great, keep it up. If it's not working, I think it's time to be a little creative and improve our herds.
Thank you again to Deb Brown with the Irish Black Cattle Association. If you know of a topic or a person we should highlight, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. And we're always taking Farmer of the Week nominations. You can nominate a farmer by going to myaglife.com, click on Daily News, then in the upper right-hand corner, click Nominate a Farmer. While you're on the website, don't forget to check out the new calendar of events as well. This has been the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.